Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Aaron Arora, the Bishop of Kirkstall in the Diocese of Leeds and the Honorary Canon of Ripon Cathedral. Aaron has written the excellent book, Stick With Love, which is the Archbishop of York's Advent book for this year. Aaron, one of the saints that you feature in your book, Saint John of Damascus, he defended icons by pointing to the incarnation of Jesus. Now, I know that traditionally some parts of the church have been sort of fairly wary of images. I mean, why do you think that is? And do you think that images are an important part of Christian worship?
I think the suspicion of images and images of God is something we can trace back to what we read of the people of God in the Old Testament, the way that when they departed from God, from the golden calf onwards, images that point to idolatry. And I think that's at the heart of the suspicion of images of God that either reduce or replace God to an image. And we know that different faith traditions still hold that to be the case, that images of God are banned for that sense of it being idolatry. I think what St. John of Damascus sought to do, and it's a tradition that is really venerated and still practiced, particularly in the Eastern Church and the Orthodox Church, where the use of icons is something that is used frequently to focus on God. I think what St. John of Damascus argued was that the image of God shouldn't be confused with God himself, that actually icons are there to assist in a focus on God rather than to replace or reduce the image of God. But key to that is the incarnation, and key to the difference I think of that we take with other faith traditions in that is the fact that once God enters into human history as Jesus Christ, then actually doing representations of what Jesus looked like in and of itself is not idolatry, but is actually reflecting the fact that God took human form and became human. I think the really interesting question around all of this, Ruth, is what does this say to us now? So we now live in a society where digital imagery particularly is huge. We know that on social, you know, it's all about Insta, TikTok, YouTube, that it's visual imagery more than anything that has now really become and leads our information, particularly but not exclusively amongst the young. And within that, where are our pictures of Christ? Where are our images of Jesus? Many years ago now, the Methodist Church came up with USPG came up with a brilliant resource called The Christ We Share, which was different images of Jesus from different communities and countries from across the world. And those different understandings that presented of who God is in that representation of Jesus, the different characteristics of God that you see at work. But we're now in a place, I think, where in this image-driven world, the images of God have been squeezed out. And I think there's a real question for us about what we should be doing to promote those. If so, what images we use, but how we introduce Jesus visually into the conversation.
That's a really interesting question, isn't it? And I guess one that is probably not going to be answered straight away or in a simple way. What I love is that every day you have a different person, saint with a little s, as you say. And I guess one of the people whose image has perhaps been sort of distorted or changed along the years is St. Nicholas. You mention him in your book, and I guess your depiction may be a little bit surprising for anyone who's come across him as a portly old man dressed in red. I mean, would you just share a little bit about who the real St. Nicholas was?
So the real St. Nicholas, Nicholas of Myra, which is in Turkey, was a bishop whose name kind of really came to the forefront during the Council of Nicaea. And of course, the Council of Nicaea is where we now get the Nicene Creed, a gathering, a synod of bishops in the church. And during that, the bishops debated what became known as the Arian heresy, named after Arius, the bishop, who advocated that whilst Jesus was special, whilst Jesus was exceptional, that fundamentally, Jesus was not divine. And so the legend goes, as Arius articulated this, explained this, expounded his view, Nicholas of Myra got more and more upset and more enraged, up to the point where he walked across and slapped Arius in the face. Now, the Roman emperor was in the room when this happened. And of course, you're not supposed to, at that point, have acts of violence in front of the emperor. So Nicholas was arrested and chained and imprisoned during the rest of the council, but released at the end. And so actually, one of the things that he became famous for was his understanding and absolute commitment to the divinity of Jesus Christ, to who Jesus was and is in terms of being both God and man. And that commitment to the divinity of Christ led him to do something unwise in terms of an act of violence, but certainly became something that first cemented who he was.
And obviously that's sort of something we celebrate at Christmas, the divine baby being born as man, God and man. I mean, why does it matter who Jesus was and is? Why was it so important for Bishop Nicholas, do you think?
I think what I go on to talk about in that particular chapter is that for a number of people, that Jesus, and it's almost the old C.S. Lewis formation around this, that who do you consider Jesus to be? You know, was he mad? Was he bad? Or was he true? And you have, both in popular culture, people like the novelist and author Philip Pullman, who's written a novel that tries to, that basically takes this same theory that Jesus may have been a good man, but actually that's all he was. You even have, I remember years ago seeing a picture of Richard Dawkins holding a T-shirt saying "Atheists for Jesus," arguing that, yeah, Jesus was a great teacher. So no denial that Jesus existed, but just saying, yeah, he probably existed, he was great. But if he lived in this day and time, there's no way he'd believe in God because he'd instead understand scientific advancement. But actually, I'm persuaded less by those than a story I came across of a young girl called Miriam in a refugee camp who fled from Iraq and who was interviewed on the Sat7 satellite channel on Sat7 Kids. And Miriam speaks about her faith in Jesus and sitting in a refugee camp without home, having just fled from war. She talks about, for her, who Jesus is, how she doesn't hold grudges against those who've driven her out of the family, of how God will protect her and her family, and how she owes everything that is good in her life to Jesus. And it's a wonderful testimony to the power of understanding who Jesus is, and for me, so much more persuasive than perhaps popular culture authors or atheists.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Well, I guess you mentioned Miriam there, and there's lots of people in your story that you mentioned who, you know, the situations that they're in are just awful. And Leah Sharabu is one of the people that you talk about. I mean, how are we to respond to stories of people like Leah Sharabu where there isn't yet, obviously, a happy ending? I mean, how are we supposed to deal with that? And what does Christmas sort of speak into those situations for us?
I suppose part of it fundamentally are the big questions around what seems to be unanswered prayer. When we cry out to God, it's something we hear and read about in the Psalms. Yeah, how long, O Lord? How long? How long will these people be in captivity? And whether that's the psalmist speaking of the Babylonian captivity, or whether it's us talking about our Christian sisters and brothers who are in captivity now, that we look to God, that we're faithful and earnest in our prayer for them, for their freedom and for their release. I mean, alongside that story of Leah, who remains in captivity in Nigeria with Boko Haram and ISIS fighters, and Leah's parents still calling on the Nigerian government to intervene and calling on Christian women and men around the world to pray for Leah. Alongside her story, the stories of others who have been released, who have found freedom after years of captivity, and people praying. The story of Asiya Bibi in Pakistan, of Helen Bahan in Eritrea. Earlier, I know for me, she's not in the book. People like the Russian poet Irina Rutinshinskaya, who's, again, her story, a Christian woman who was imprisoned during the time of the Soviet Union. These are stories of hope. where we continually pray and seek God's answer. I think the reason why Christmas speaks to that is in some ways the song of Simeon, who had been promised and was waiting for the salvation of the Jews to see God's light and in the temple with Christ in his arms as a child, says, "Now, Lord, you can let your servant go in peace, for mine eyes have seen the salvation of your people, a light to reveal you to the Gentiles." And there is in that prayer the recognition of God's promises fulfilled in Christ, of Simeon's waiting being fulfilled in the temple, in God's promise of the Messiah being something that he saw. And I think for us it is that same sense of waiting on the promises of God to be fulfilled, not passively, but earnestly, with our hearts crying out and yearning for justice for those who suffer.
Talk to me about the Reverend Canon Jemima Prasadam.
Oh, Auntie Jemima. Auntie Jemima is absolutely wonderful. She, I first met her in Birmingham, 5 foot nothing, in a dog collar and a sari, working in one of the hardest inner city parishes in Birmingham, a place of riots, of high knife and gun crime, where her ministry and her passion for Jesus was both innovative and practical at the same time. Jemima, who was a priest of St. Paul and St. Silas in Lascelles in Birmingham, practiced something called bus stop theology. There were 6 bus stops. Jemima doesn't drive, and there were 6 bus stops in the walk between the vicarage and the church. And so she would make it part of her daily routine. Whenever she walked to church, which she did every day, or walked back from church, to stop at the bus stop and to speak to anyone who was there, who was waiting, and to just chit-chat with them. But inevitably through the chit-chatting, she'd be there with a sari and a dog collar, and they'd talk about anything from the weather to whatever else, but she would talk of Jesus, unashamedly. Not in a way that sometimes you see some brothers and sisters on a street corner, you know, giving it large. Less that, but more perhaps in the words of 1 Peter, having a reason to explain the faith within, and to do so in a way that was respectful to whoever she was engaging with. And she's absolutely stunning, not only in her way to speak about Jesus so naturally, but also in the way that she rooted communities and brought Jesus into it, and brought practical demonstrations of Jesus' love into a place of great economic hardship. Jemima, also a great entrepreneur, so one of the things that she noticed, for instance, was that particular area of Birmingham had been designated as a dispersal area for asylum seekers. And at the time, there were a number there from the Democratic Republic of Congo, whose first language is French. And, of course, there were kids, both in the area and who came to church, who were struggling learning French at school. So she thought, now I can see a way here of bringing different people together to bless one another for these asylum seekers who had no community, who were alone, who had no sense of were far from home and no sense of being with anyone else, suddenly were being invited to church and saying, come and bless us. Come and bless us with your knowledge of French, which you speak naturally, and help teach these kids. And for kids, engaging with these people who had fled persecution, in a way that was respectful and honouring. And in those interactions, Jesus is present.
We could certainly all learn a lot from Auntie Jemima, couldn't we? I mean, one of the things that I definitely learned through your book was that George Floyd became a Christian while in prison. I mean, some people may not know that, but what are the many, many things that we can learn from George Floyd's inspirational life and then his tragic death?
I think one of the things that struck me after the death of George Floyd was the number of people who were so keen to misrepresent him as and focus entirely on his criminal past and to airbrush from his story redemption, faith, and a living faith in Jesus. I think people who perhaps found the reaction, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, to be something that they either struggled with or opposed, went to look at what happened with George Floyd, whose brutal murder and death was so traumatic, in the way that years ago witnessing a lynching was traumatic. But somehow they sought to minimise the consequences of that by minimising George himself. And I think his story is very human in terms of somebody from a difficult background with great promise, particularly as a basketball player, had great sporting promise, came off the rails. Some of that involved crime and drugs. But then discovered faith and turned his life around, worked with the churches in his area to introduce pastors and church workers to people who were on the edge, who started making his own vlogs and videos challenging gun violence, and who could speak to people who respected him, young men in particular, because they knew that he had experienced this. So he wasn't preaching to them from a place of not understanding or not knowing, but he was sharing his views with them from a place of having been through it. And he, within that, and he wouldn't be alone, Ruth, in this, there but for the grace of God go each of us when we come to a place where we fall. We are broken when the words of Psalm 51 become deeply relevant to us individually in terms of our brokenness before God, and we are restored and redeemed. And, you know, sometimes we fall again. And that happened in George's life. But what was clear was his commitment, his trajectory, his reaching out and response to the love of God. Does that mean George Floyd led a sinless life and therefore should be beatified? No. Does it mean that he was, like the rest of us, someone seeking to respond to the love of God in his life with the circumstances that he faced and point others to Jesus? Yes, it does. I think it was Augustine who famously said that every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. That sense that all of those who we honour as saints, not least Augustine himself, don't come without histories. And regardless of that, for each of us, there is the promise of redemption in Christ and forgiveness. And George was living that at the time of his brutal murder.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.